Live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California and in parallel from the Turfs Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
And a pleasant good afternoon, everybody. Hope everybody's having a great time. Welcome to the Water Zone. I'm Rob Starr, along with a gentleman who is meticulous and fastidious and fanatic and proficient, masterful, overall hydraulic wizard, Mr. Chris Davey.
Thank you, Rob.
Every time you do an introduction like that, I have to get out my Funkin' Wagnalls dictionary and go look at the words.
I try to remember all the words I think about you all the time, so... But you certainly impressed me, and you certainly impressed all our customers that we've ever had and our audience. And besides from that, the most important thing, you're a good friend, and you make me laugh a lot, so I appreciate that. And laughing, the doctor says, keeps you happy and healthy. So thank you very much for that.
Right back at you, Rob.
But I thought you told me I should keep my day job. My jokes weren't really good, so I got a question on that. Anyhow. I want to bring in Ms. Chris Austin in California as well. Chris, Ms. Austin, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. How are y'all doing?
We'd be fine. How's everything up in the middle of the country in California?
Man, not quite the middle of the country, but yeah.
Well, in California it is.
Yeah, you know, we had a couple of hot days, even had to turn on the air conditioner, and today it kind of cooled off, and we've actually had a little bit of rain, not a lot, just enough to kind of, well, to make our cars all dirty, although not like in L.A. when you get a little bit of rain, and there's not nearly as much dirt in the air here, but yeah, it's kind of a cool day, very nice up here.
Yeah. It was reached 100 yesterday here in Arizona. It's around 80-something now. Sunshine, beautiful weather. Mr. Davey, how do you see it up there in Claremont?
Southern California has yet to discover that it is mid-spring, buddy. It is. It got maybe 62 today down here, and we had a drizzly, wet, sort of overcast, gloomy, gray morning. And so far, I'm looking out the window right now, there are still gray, fluffy clouds covering the sun.
Is the gas prices still ridiculous?
They are nuts. As you know, my diesel, my truck is diesel, and it is, the middle $5 per gallon. So when I fill that 26-gallon tank up, my card stops at $100 and I have to re-swipe.
Sorry about that.
Then you have my car, and my car takes 7.5 gallons. So,
that's not bad. How far distance can you get?
About 350 miles. So
that's not bad.
It only has three cylinders, though.
Well,
trucks passed me going up the mountain, but
yeah. there was an article I had read a couple years ago, and I got to go back and look it up about it. And speaking of water and cars and everything else, there was this French car company that developed some prototype automobiles that ran on water. And I got to find that article and get more interested in that and see if that's still a viable thing. But anyway,
there's a guy in Long Beach that has built a car that turns into a boat. So he can drive down the boat ramp, and then it turns into a boat, and he can boat around, and then he comes back, and he drives up the boat ramp, and it's no longer a boat.
I think I remember back in this, date myself here, in the 60s, that there was a company that made a car that did that. I can't remember the name of that.
There's one of them now, though. It was in last week's Sunday Digest. I had a little video of it. I thought, hey, that's pretty interesting.
Well, I'd be freaked out if the doors leaked. So, you'd be in trouble. Anyway, what's in the news today about some reclamation, Department of Reclamation increases CVP allocations? Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, well, we got some news on the water allocations, and they were previously, It like most things in California water, where you are in the state depends on, you know, how good or bad the news is. And for most everybody north of the Delta, north of Sacramento, they're all getting 100% of their allocations. But the folks that are south of the Delta, south of Sacramento, are not. They bumped up from 35% to 40% for both the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project. Most affected is Central Valley agriculture, predominantly, and some cities, some municipalities, but it's not, they're generally are pretty good to the municipalities and the situation. So the cities, I think, are at 75%. But the ag is at 40%, and they're not happy about this, as you can probably imagine. Yeah, and the State Water Project serves Southern California and the Bay Area, parts of the Central Coast. And I am not sure how other cities are dealing with this, but I do know that Metropolitan Water District, which serves most of the Southern California, almost entire Southern California, is not really projecting any shortages. They were kind of aware that it was going to be this way, so they're well prepared. Other cities may, you know, that are more dependent on the State Water Project may have some trouble this year. We'll have to just see how that shakes out. The reason, I can imagine some of our listeners are kind of wondering why these allocations are low when we're getting all these news stories about, you know, Lake Shasta and Oroville getting almost full to capacity. And that is because we had some issues at the export pumps in the Delta. So the water comes down from Northern California and goes into the Delta, and then it's pumped from the Delta. Both the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project pump from the Delta, and from there it goes to San Luis Reservoir. San Luis Reservoir is outside of Los Banos. It's like a large off-stream reservoir. It's jointly owned by both the state and the feds. So there's a share in that reservoir, a portion for the State Water Project, a portion for the Central Valley Project. And that reservoir is only at 74%. So that is why the folks south of the Delta have the lower allocation. To get water from Shasta or Oroville, to get it down to points south of the Delta, it would have to flow through the Delta and be pumped from the Delta at some point. And it's kind of hard to find the capacity these days. You know, there's not a lot of windows of opportunity to move transfer water. So, it could be a little tight for those that are south of the Delta that are looking for water. And if you all remember, if you follow the blog, and we might have talked about it on the show, a while back there were stories about how fish were getting caught up in the pumps, outside of the pumps. Yeah. Yep. That is what we're talking about here. This is the end result of that, is that there's not a lot of water in San Luis Reservoir. Therefore, the allocations are low.
Mm. Well, you know, the fish serve a purpose, but they also don't help out when we need it. It's kind of a shame with that. But
yeah, and, you know, here's where the folks that are tunnel proponents would tell you that, here's an instance when we would have been able to have been taking water from the North Delta rather than the South Delta. That would not have caused the problems that they had, wouldn't have caused the fish death at the pump. because you'd be taking it up north, you know, and so the water doesn't flow through. It's taken out before it goes in the delta. Therefore, there are much less fishery impact.
Yeah, I think the fish are revolting because I saw another thing you had in your blog about that, I forget where it was right off the top of my head. I just read it real quick about some fish that they don't want your pets to eat raw.
Oh, yeah, well, that's a good story to talk about briefly. Yeah, you know, the salmon come up the rivers and they spawn and they die. And so at various times of the year when the salmon are coming up, you could be walking along the American River in Sacramento and there are dead salmon, you know, there in the water. You can actually see the salmon coming up. So, you know, the right times of the year, the salmon trying to jump up and move up the river, it looks like it's a very tedious job to do.
Right.
So anyways, so the Department of Fish and Wildlife is just putting out a warning that you should not let your dogs eat these dead fish carcasses because there is a bacteria in there that's really kind of specific to dogs that will make them sick if they do so. So. Yeah. You know, just a reminder.
I hope nobody scams those things and takes them and sells them as sushi because that would be really bad.
Actually, no, you couldn't do that. Actually, when the salmon get ready to spawn, their flesh actually inside becomes less pink. It actually turns to white. It's still edible. And what they do is they actually, when the hatcheries take in the fish to spawn, they do actually send out the salmon. It is edible, so it is sent out to, I think, you know, help out hungry people. But if you saw it on your sushi, you would probably know something was wrong. Put it that way.
I'll tell you, Chris, I don't saw this, but scientists in Oregon found a partially skeleton of a large prehistoric salmon with big fangs in the front, right? I mean, big hooked teeth in the front. Probably grew to be 300 to 600 pounds. That's a lot of sushi right there. Of course, if you made a roll out of it, it would obviously be called the fang roll, but, you know, that's just me.
Well, yeah, just about maybe before we go to a commercial break, but real quick, there's a story that's happening up in, for Valley Water is working to reduce what they call methyl mercury, some toxin they found in the local waterways. And that started, I believe, from happening in 1845 to 1971 for some mining district. How come it's taking so long to do that? What's going on with that real quick?
Well, actually, you know, the truth is that there's nothing unusual about that so much it's all over. The gold rush, these are old gold rush mines that have been sitting there on the landscape for decades. The one in San Jose is just one. They're leaching all sorts of toxins out into the waterways. There's a number of them up here in Northern California. And we know about these. We declare them as Superfund sites. It's very expensive to clean up, and hence it has not been cleaned up. But yet, yes, here in 2024, we are still impacted by things that happened in the gold rush.
Wow.
And will continue to be so for as far as I can see.
Amazing. Well, Chris, I understand you're going to be traveling next week, so we're probably not going to hear you on the show, maybe for the next 2 weeks. So we wish you a safe trip, and we're going to go to our break and then have our guest that's actually overseas. And he's, I think, 9 or 10 hours difference than we are. So it's probably the middle of morning for him, right, Chris?
It's about 20 after 1 in the morning for him.
Wow. So anyway, Chris, you travel safe. And people, please go to mavensnotebook.com, become a subscriber, and you get stuff every single morning, and it gives you all this information. Really good articles, stories that you'd never find anywhere else. And you can also become a sponsor of that. And Chris and I are both that, and we support her, and we want to make sure she's doing her job. I don't know, how she does it every single night. I do not know. I think she has little elves she's hired to do the typing. I don't know. Or you have more hands than we can, that we can see with all the typing you must do. But, Chris, thank you very much. We do appreciate it. And we will talk to you hopefully in the next 2 weeks.
All right. See you later. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back with our featured guest. So stick around, and we'll be back.
Out there, you're on your own. Do more. Do it faster. Do it better. The work is tough, and building an experienced team is even tougher. The moment you've got the game figured out, everything changes. It's hard to know where you stand, but in here, you'll find your footing. It's a place that's as much a community as it is a store. A place where knowing you and your business go deeper than simply knowing your name. A place where the solutions aren't limited to what's on the shelf, and the experts behind the counter pride themselves on going beyond the call. In here, you'll find people who see eye to eye, who stand shoulder to shoulder, who work side by side to build things, great things. In here, you'll find common ground. We are Site One, stronger together.
Well, all right, listeners, and thank you for sticking with us here on the Water Zone. For our guest today, we'd like to welcome Thomas Schumann, who is the CEO of Thomas Schumann Capital. He has offices in Frankfurt, New York, and Dubai. So welcome to the Water Zone, Thomas.
Good evening, Chris. Thank you for having me. Good evening from Frankfurt, Germany.
And well, thank you for coming on the show, definitely. So listen, among the many, many things that you're doing, and we'll give you a chance to talk about that in just a minute. One is tackling the issue of water scarcity and water security, which is going to be our topic for this segment. And believe me, Rob and I are so excited to hear about what you're doing, how you're involved in an unconventional approach known as glacial water harnessing. And we'll talk about that in a bit. But just for some background for our listeners, Thomas, if you would, could you please tell us just a bit about yourself, what got you to where you are today, if you will, right? And especially what drove your focus on water issues?
Sure. Well, I was born, raised, and educated in Frankfurt, Germany. And then I was in 1996, I decided to immigrate to the U.S., to Santa Monica. And my background is very multifaceted. I had different ventures in the past. I used to be a banker as well for some time. And then in 2010, 2011, I came to a point in my life when I really asked myself and asked God, what is it really that I should do with my life? What is my purpose? What is my calling? And that's when the universe pointed me towards water. So I entered the water space initially. Trying to resurrect a defunct artesian spring water brand up in the Idaho mountains, Paradise, Idaho, called Trinity Waters. And that got me into the space. And then that was 2011. We had the big drought in California. And I got deeper into the space. I launched an online water cluster. It was actually called watercluster.com to allow the stakeholders in the water space, which was water technology companies, corporates, utilities, investors, academia, NGOs, to connect, collaborate, and communicate. I reached out to the EPA. They had several water clusters across the United States, but there was nothing going on in California, which was kind of strange because we dealt with this millennial water crisis. And so I got deeper into the space, and then fast forward, I helped some water technology companies and some large desalination projects with their financing needs. And in 2017, I started to develop the first benchmark index family, equity index family, to allow global capital markets to quantify and qualify water risk and equity. So basically, we took the Euro Stoxx 50, we took the S&P 500, and we looked at all the companies, all the corporates, and we developed a technology, I'm sorry, a methodology to understand which companies are good water stewards and which companies still have to step up the water stewardship. So that's what I'm still doing in the capital markets arena. We're also launching an ETF out of the UK this year that's going to track the index, a global index. And then on the more tangible, you could say, private market side, I started Project Greenland 4 years ago, and that's to harvest the glacier melt fresh water and then transfer it in large dedicated bulk vessels, which can hold 40 million liters, to drought-stricken regions, which is, you know, obviously the MENA region, but we already have drought situations here in Barcelona, in Sicily, in Tenerife. UK has huge water problems. Morocco has immense water stress. So that's currently the main focus, to really create, change on the ground, impact on the ground, to transfer super premium Arctic fresh water to regions that really need it. And I'm doing that overall. The overall focus is obviously SDG 6. Probably, you know, most of your listeners have heard about the Agenda 2030. These are the 17 United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, and SDG 6 is completely focused on providing access to clean water and sanitation. And I personally believe that SDG 6 is the foundation of all the other remaining 11 SDGs, because water is life. With water, without water, there is no human life, there is no economy, there is no society, no nothing. So that's why my focus, my passion, my commitment, my legacy is all about water security.
Well, that was a great story, for sure. A lot going on there, and great direction on what brought you to where you're doing, to what you're doing today. Let's jump kind of right into the water scarcity issue, if you will, right? And you and I have had a conversation or an email before about how we both saw how water was, you know, kind of like the occasional news story in the past, where today water is the news, right? And one thing that you said at that time, yeah, exactly, Thomas. And one thing you said at that time is water is the one permanent asset in the world. So from your viewpoint, can you kind of describe, tell our listeners a little bit about what water scarcity is? You said a little bit of it in your introduction there, but where it stands today, and kind of if we can take a look at water scarcity, which is the available water for basic needs like drinking and hygiene, and contrast that against water stress, which is how much fresh water we remove from available fresh water sources. I know that was a packed question, so I hope you were paying attention, Thomas.
Sure. Chris, I assume that you've probably been longer in the water space than me. I've just, crossed the first decade. So, I think it's all about the narrative. We have to be very careful when we speak about water scarcity, because water really doesn't change its volume. It just changes its form and its availability, right? So because of, climate change, we're dealing now with situations where there's too much water and there's too less water of it. So that's pretty much what it comes down to. But the underlying challenge is multifold. First of all, we never appreciated water. That's really something that we all have to look in the mirror. And we never respected, valued this single most precious resource that we are gifted with, as humans on the planet. And then there's obviously exponential population growth, and there's also the challenge that water has never been properly priced, so it's still mispriced, and that's also what we've been kind of like extracting. With the index that we created, it's just not priced properly. And why hasn't water been priced properly? That's always the big question we have to ask ourselves, because specifically in the Western Hemisphere, it's been taken for granted. It's a given. You turn on the faucet and water comes out, and people don't really think that there's a huge $600 billion industry, behind there that makes that possible, right? I mean, their pipes, their valves, their utilities, their dams, their aquifers, their aqueducts. So, it's the challenge is still, with human behavior, and climate change doesn't help, because the planet is heating up, and with the planet being heating up, there's less water available, in the areas that we need it. And then just recently, as you've probably been aware as well in the U.S., all of a sudden, the population is and stakeholders are becoming aware that the water in the U.S. is pretty much polluted through PFAS, through lead. The infrastructure in the United States is more than 100 years old. We have, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, I think more than $1 trillion, that's with a T, water infrastructure financing gap. So all these different components are coming together to create that perfect storm where we are, quickly have to wake up to realize that the climate crisis is a water crisis. And again, back to the narrative of the mainstream media, the focus needs to be on water, not on climate.
This is Rob. Welcome to the show, Tom. Hope everything's doing well in Frankfurt for you. Can we get into a little bit of a sense of urgency, like the UN conference and of the parties' climate summit? What do you see and what's happening there with these issues? Because, going back to what you had just said, about a decade ago here in the United States, most water agencies started looking at tiered rate billings. So instead of one fee that they would rate that they would charge, it depends on how much water you use, and the more you use, the higher the rate goes. So maybe you can kind of move that into the sense of urgency and what people are doing around the world.
Well, if you follow the news stories, which the headlines about water and drought and different other keywords, which I've been doing now for consistently, I think on a daily basis for the last 4 or 5 years, you can see that the frequency of the media reporting about water and stakeholders becoming more aware about water issues is really, exponentially increasing, almost like with the challenges that we're dealing with through climate. Still, there is, a global lack of awareness, a global lack of consciousness. I was fortunate enough to attend the first UN Water Conference that was held last year in New York. It was pretty amazing to see, you had people, I think it was like 6,000 to 7,000 attendees from all over the world. And it was really like every facet of our society was represented, and people came in their local cultural outfits from Africa, Native American Indians from India, all around the world. So it was good to see, but, at the end of the conference, really, it was just talk, and we don't have the time anymore. It's really all about action. And so it's really imperative and urgent that people need to realize that water is the single most precious resource, and that change can quickly happen through people understanding that reuse, reduce, and recycling is the easiest and quickest way to proper water stewardship. But then again, and I'm American myself, so please don't take that personal. Americans only change their behavior when it hurts, in the wallet. So that's going back to tiered pricing. There needs to be a change, and water needs to be priced properly. If you have been living the last 25 years in Los Angeles, I don't know what the gallon of gasoline costs at the moment. It's probably around $5. And if people are willing to pay $5 for a gallon of gas, but they're not willing to pay a few cents for a gallon of water, and there's something terribly wrong with that picture.
Yeah, you're right. You turn on the faucet and water pours out, and people just expect it to be. I believe the U.S., North America is one of the lowest rates for water. I know, looking over at Israel or Europe or other places, it's much 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 higher. In some of those meetings that the UN Water Summit talked about, they talked about reducing some subsidies in agriculture. But as you know, and mentioned at the beginning, water is life, and you can't have it, can't not have that. You need it, but we also need food. And they used to give, or still give, a lot of rebates here in the United States for residents and homes. But I think if they turn that, my opinion is if they turn those rebates back to the agriculture world, because their technology is getting a lot better these days with different types of irrigation types, whether it's flood or drip or some other type technology. They seem to be very intelligent about how to save water and make sure that they use every single drop. But I believe you got to have a balance between supporting agriculture and doing safe, clean water to drink. I believe in recycling. I think that's a big deal. And I know a lot of companies are doing that. And there's more projects all over the world that's going to happen with that. But what's your opinion or and your vision on the agriculture world using water?
Well, we know that agriculture and also animal agriculture is the single largest user of water worldwide, right? So it probably require that we change our agricultural and food growing and specifically eating habits as well. Most people in America are not aware of the water footprint of the different products they consume there, and they're not aware that, for example, a hamburger, requires more than, I think it's more than 500 gallons of water for one hamburger. I mean, think about that. Yeah. So again, it comes back to ignorance. It comes back to, lack of education. It comes down to convenience. And it's a human psychological situation where we as humans only change once we are under duress, under distress, under pain, suffering. And it all goes back to the good Benjamin Franklin, and he says, we know the worth of water, the value of water when the faucet runs dry, when the well is dry, right? So yeah. Unfortunately, I think it has to come to that point that people really change their behavior, and once behaviors are changed, I think then we can restart. We can restart fresh. You talk to people, for example, in the MENA region, in desert regions, they know how precious water is. I mean, look at Israel. Israel is the poster child, the benchmark of water stewardship. They turned their nation around from a water deficit to water surplus. They invented drip irrigation. They're educating their kids already in school to become water citizens. They have water governance. They have water policies. They're investing in water technology, and that's something that the U.S. is way, way, way behind.
Well, Thomas and Rob, I'll say one quick thing. It's a big week this week globally, right? Because this week is UN World Water Day and the Water Summit, which, by the way, is in your birthplace, Thomas, in Frankfurt this year, probably close to you. And the theme is water for peace. Mm-hmm. Still got to remind ourselves, 2.2 billion people in the world today, billion with a B, lack access to safe drinking water, right?
Yes, that's true. Yeah, it's getting more by the day because of, climate change and human migration. We have, huge issues in Africa. We have, I think, the biggest, it's probably happening already, the biggest hunger crisis. And in Sudan and Ethiopia, obviously, that doesn't hit home in America. But again, if you speak about America, the infrastructure is completely outdated. If you look at the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, there's only basically drops in the bucket being allocated to water and water security and rebuilding infrastructure, updating infrastructure. So we're dealing with major problems in the most developed nation in the world. And it's becoming more and more prevalent, that the water is actually polluted through PFAS. It's not only socioeconomic weak regions that face these problems, like Flint, Michigan, other regions. It's really nationwide, and we still don't have any filtration and purification systems in place that, for example, filter out all the prescription drugs that are being flushed down the toilets every day from Americans, right? I mean, America is the largest user of prescription drugs, and what people do, once they don't use them anymore, they just flush them down the toilet. So what does that do? It basically toxifies, pollutes the water, and it changes the endocrine system, and it causes potentially all kinds of issues, related to cancer, Alzheimer's, et cetera, et cetera. And these are just issues that we're becoming aware about, and the EPA finally is recognizing that and also trying to tackle it. So we have to start at home first to clean up our Water Act.
Well, I tell you, you made a comment just a few minutes ago, Thomas. I want to kind of bounce on that just a quick bit, because it was concerning, sort of the idea that there's a lot of people working on this problem, meeting this week, of course, in Frankfurt to work on it. But a comment you made that maybe we should let me ask you a question about, because you said lots of countries still, governments in those countries, really maybe aren't taking it seriously, and right, they've tried and failed to take meaningful action. Is that still ongoing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, it's you know, it goes back to ignorance. It goes back to lack of education. Goes back to convenience. But you know, just think about it. You don't have to look far, you don't have to look that far. You know, you're in Southern California. If you look at the Metropolitan Water sure. District, different agencies, why would any politician vouch to raise water tariffs? He would not be reelected. So that in itself doesn't make any, you know, that's why the system is broken. It doesn't work.
Yeah, geographically in the world, do you still think that the Middle East and North Africa are struggling the most with water scarcity?
Oh, they do. I just basically, you know, relocated myself personally, professionally, also to Dubai. So the challenge with Dubai is it's a beautiful nation. It's growing very fast, very safe, very secure, very progressive, major innovation. But the Achilles heel is that this nation runs 99% on desalinated water. So just to give you an idea, I'm an endurance athlete. I'm a triathlete. So I went to swimming in the mornings with my team, you know, in the Arabian Sea there. And I said to my salty, and it's so salty that basically it makes your throat burn. And he said, well, because they're discharging all the brine back into the ocean, which destroys marine life, right? Increases the salinity. So the Middle East is running still on diesel, which is a completely outdated technology. First of all, it has a huge carbon footprint. It takes years to get a diesel plant online, has a huge capex, a huge opex. And then lastly, the water that you get out of that, even though it's being run through reverse osmosis, is bad tasting, non-nutrient, basically dead water. So that's the problem in the Middle East, and they're trying to figure that out. In Germany, we're still very blessed. We have, you know, still a lot of water here, but as Jay Famiglietti, you probably heard his name, you know, yep. He was part of a documentary last year, and he made the case, and he used some data from NASA that even Germany has been overdrawing its groundwater, depleting its groundwater. And that's one of the big challenges because, as you know, Chris, you're in that space. Once you deplete an aquifer, it takes years or decades for the aquifer to recharge, right? So it's basically what we're doing as, you know, as a society, we're taking our savings accounts, and we've been taking consistently more money out that's in there. We have been overdrawing the savings account, which is technically not possible. You know, and now we're dealing with the outfall of that, with the consequences, and they will be dire. They will be dire. There's no question about that, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question about water security. And you, we have an upcoming two-part segment with some people who are former undersecretaries of state and defense, and people from the FBI talking about water security and basically cybersecurity. But there's other issues with water security. You know, we talked a lot. As water, as it relates to the world's basic needs like drinking water, hygiene, sanitation, ag, and everything else in that bundle. But how important is water security to the world's challenges like energy, an example of a carbon shift as it's been named? How does that all play in?
So the first part of your comment or of your question, water security is actually national security. And Vice President Kamala Harris has for the first time, I think it was in June of 2022, she announced the action plan on global water security, but really not much action has followed on it, unfortunately. So there are factions in the government that are aware that if, you know, the U.S. and also, you know, the allies and other nations don't get water security implemented, that, you know, will result in more wars and conflict and tensions, et cetera, et cetera. So water security is actually national security. And then lately, if you've read the headlines as well, there have been some cyber attacks on U.S. water utilities. So that really should wake up Washington as well and put it on the plan and put it on high alert. So it's really all about water that we really have to put a focus on. And again, I say it again, climate is water. The climate crisis is a water crisis. So we have to get our priorities right, and the mainstream media has to get their story right to really, you know, elevate water as the top topic and theme and everything that's being reported and storied around climate. That's very, very important.
Well, it's a two-part question here. First part is talking about maybe what Qatar and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia do, but what about, because of the way the world has a lot of tensions, for example, let's take Israel, for example, and in Russia, you know, Israel sells water to their enemy right now. They sell it to up through the Iran and some other places. So there's lots of tensions going on. So as far as, you know, drinking water and hygiene and sanitation, that's all good and we all need that. But there's we've noticed that there's some terrorist states that are doing cyber attacks onto water treatment plants and things. So how does that all come together? Because everybody, it's not just the hygiene and all that. I mean, they could damage our water supply by having a cyber attack and changing formulations to purify water. How does that all bundle together? And what is Qatar doing and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia? Are they looking at all those angles?
I do not know. I have not spoken with the powers to be in the UAE and in KSA, but they have a big focus specifically, Saudi Arabia. They just launched the Saudi Water Partnership, and I think they applied for also the World Water Summit to be in Saudi Arabia, I think, in 2027. So they have a big focus on that. They obviously understand water in terms of the other actors that you mentioned. Yeah, unfortunately, water has just recently has been used as and I'm saying that because we have World Water Day coming up, and this year's theme is Water for Peace. But water has just recently been used as a weapon, and has been used by Russia. They attacked certain targets in the Ukraine. Water utilities and water supply. That was all strategic. And unfortunately, I have to say that as well. Israel is very, very strategic in utilizing and leveraging the water infrastructure. They took, I think, more than a decade control of the whole water infrastructure in Gaza, complete control. And one of the first things they did after October 7th, they shut down the water. And they're still doing that because they know that that's the most powerful weapon, that brings any enemy to their knees. So water is, as we speak here, is being used as a weapon of mass destruction. So we have to be very, very careful. And, water is very powerful. Water brings life, but it also destroys life.
No, you're absolutely right. Just one last quick question for me. I see a lot of things in the ag world, especially with water, okay? And, you mentioned about the brine being pumped back into the ocean. There's, and plus the energy to run that. I think a lot of money should be develop private industry to come up with ways to how do we fix the brine? How can we change it to a useful purpose? How can we, instead of powering everything with electric heavy, why can't we do it with solar power? I mean, I think there should be a lot of monies in the UN or discussing that with different nations to put their energy and money into developing technology to help make those things a viable and cost reliable and cost reduction situation for water manufacturing. I'll use it that word, or water producing.
Yes, I fully agree. But, again, it takes, because when you deal with water, you're always dealing, with the public and private sector, because, water is not a commodity. It's a resource. And as we know, in 2015, the United Nations recognized it as a human right. But with human rights, there also come huge responsibilities. Going back to energy, I think one of the solutions would be, or could be, if there are tax credits, if you implement, obviously, water stewardship and, energy stewardship, just, same with carbon credits. That's something that needs to come from Washington, obviously, to provide a financial incentive for the private sector. But again, back to energy, the energy transition can't happen without water security. That's very, very clear. And we have to be very aware of that. The energy transition cannot happen without water security. So water security again comes first, to shift away from to renewables.
A number of challenges for sure, Thomas, going on here. And it's, as I said before, it's good to know that there are people working on this. But let's shift while we have a few minutes left here, and we'll talk about something that you're involved with especially from your standpoint, looking at unconventional water resources, if you will, quote unquote. And, you know, some of those are out there and have been around for a while, like desal, wastewater, and all that sort of stuff. Fog harnessing, cloud seeding, lots of other things like that. Additional groundwater resources that we haven't been able to tap yet because they're under seabeds, et cetera. But one of them is glacial water harnessing. Why don't you tell our listeners what that is?
Yeah, so the government of Greenland, I think it was in 2017, 2018, realized that they are home to 10% of the world's freshwater. So they started an ice and water for export program. But since Greenland is a very tiny country, I think their GDP is like 3 billion, 55,000 residents, small capital of Nuuk, and they realized that they cannot do it by themselves. So they commissioned scientific research and studies how to basically commercialize their fresh water, and then they came up with a tender, and there were private companies that were able to bid for freshwater exploration rights. So that all happened, and there are now 11 to 12 private companies that have the exploration rights for the next 20 years in different zones. They divvy up Greenland different zones, and basically what it comes down to is to take the glacier freshwater melt water and, you know, either bottle it or put it into semi-bulk, which would be flexi tanks. These are single-use plastic bladders where you can put in liquids such as water, and they fit into a 20-foot container, and then you can ship the water around wherever it's needed. Or what that's the approach that we're taking now, you know, shipping the water in large bulk vessels, similar to LNG, similar to petroleum, oil, chemicals, to nations where it's needed. And it's basically, it's very simple. There are no freshwater terminals in place yet because this is all a very pioneering effort and venture, but you basically bring the ship close to the waterfront, then you have some piping and high pressure pumps, you fill up the ship, and needs to have a dedicated stainless steel tanker because the water cannot be contaminated. And you basically pump the water in there and transfer the water from A to B. And currently, because of climate change, all this water is pretty much just melting every second into the oceans, causing sea level rise. But most importantly, this very precious water that is up to 100,000 years old is basically just becoming saline and forever unusable. So obviously, it would make sense to, you know, either create also storage facilities in Greenland or ship the water to other nations and have storage facilities there. And for example, Qatar is leading on that. It's the only nation in the world that has a so-called water security mega reservoir. So it gives them, the nation of Qatar, I think, a 7-day runway in terms of drinking water supply. So these are all solutions and, you know, possibilities to tap into unconventional water sources. Obviously, these UN experts that made that call upon nations to tap unconventional water resources, they're also pointing towards AWG, which is atmospheric water generation. Basically, you're taking the water out of the air. There are immense amounts of water, there are atmospheric rivers, actually, in the atmosphere, which carry huge amounts of water. So you can harvest the water from air. That's been done for thousands of years already. The Egyptians did that back in the days. They had certain devices where they took the mist overnight and funneled it through palm leaves into containers, and then in the mornings they had fresh water. There's rainwater harvesting when it rains, you know, obviously making sure that the water doesn't run off into the oceans, which Los Angeles still has not figured out. There, as you said as well, Chris, there are under the ocean bed aquifers, but it's kind of like, you know, solution of last resort. And also iceberg thawing, which has been tried for the first time. It failed the first time a few years ago, but that's still a viable option as well.
Yeah, let me point out something here, because there's a plus side of this, and I'd like you to describe for our listeners, if you will, about water quality when it comes to glacial water harnessing. I mean, this has got to be pristine water, Thomas, right?
It is, yeah. And I actually just drank it yesterday. I have a few bottles here because the one licensee that we're partnering with now, they bottled the water in glass bottles and shipped it a few years ago. They ran into some challenges during COVID. There's also another company from Iceland, and the water is super pristine. It has a great taste. It's very mineral rich, and even the original source where it comes from has only, you know, minor little bacteria that can be easily filtered out. But again, this water has not been exposed to the industrial age, so it has no pollutants. It has no microplastics. That's a big thing too now that we're dealing with, you know, because we have plastics pretty much in anything and everything and in the oceans. So it's very, very pristine water, and you have that obviously in the northern hemisphere, in the Arctic, but you also have it in the Antarctica.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Greenland. Are there any other sources? I mean, one's got to look at the globe and say there's got to be other places in the northern hemisphere and in the Arctic and Antarctic where this pristine water could be available.
Well, it's most pristine, obviously, you know, if it has been stored in ice for the longest. So that lends itself, obviously, to Alaska, where there's the Blue Lake. That's another project that we're pursuing, Project Alaska, to serve, you know, the Western Hemisphere down the West Coast. Mexico is having huge water problems, and over to Asia. But on the Greenland side, obviously, you have Canada to the north, you have Greenland, but you also have Iceland, and you have Norway. These are all kind of like the common regions where the water is easily accessible. The one prohibitive thing, but it is just what it is the transportation cost. You know, when you move water from A to B, there's a certain transportation cost, which is equivalent, you know, as moving anything else. If it's oil or if it's LNG or if it's, sneakers from China. And that's another issue that needs to be tackled by the global shipping industry. They need to pivot to renewables as well, either to wind or to solar. To bring the shipping costs down and also the carbon footprint. So that's at the moment, you know, the necessary evil we're dealing with. But, you know, it's better to have, you know, so-called a little bit more expensive water than having no water. And currently the average bottled global water price is somewhere around 55 cents. That's almost equal to oil, right? I mean, yeah. But you cannot drink oil. So water is pretty much free, you know, from the Arctic. So, I mean, you can make your calculations. It's a very logic thing.
Well, wow. I've got to tell you, what an awesome, what exciting, what a progressive topic. I mean, it's just been a great 25 minutes or so. Thomas, if some of our listeners want to find out more, want to get some more information, where can they go?
They just go to thomasschumannkapital.com or thomasschumann.com. There's also an email.
This, we could have a 3-hour conversation on this topic. It's awesome. And maybe you'll bless us with coming back in a couple of weeks and giving some more information on some of these projects that you're doing.
I would love to. And we're currently looking at doing the maiden voyage of the first ever bulk transfer of Arctic Greenland freshwater in May. So that might be a good occasion. And we have a successful proof of concept. And then obviously the vision is, as Willem Buter said it in 2011, he was the former Citibank top economist. His vision was he sees fleets of water tankers that will draw, you know, the global trade of oil and anything else. And
all right, we appreciate him on the show, and we're going to have him back in a couple of weeks. And a pretty interesting conversation about him. He's all over the world, but I want to see those tanker ships carrying that water from Alaska. So, anyway, for our listeners, please don't forget to help keep our planet blue, because if you like green, you got to have blue. We'll talk to you next week with a great featured guest again, and you guys have a safe and wonderful weekend. Thanks. Bye-bye.
NBC News on KCAA Loma Linda is sponsored by Teamsters Local 1932, protecting the future of working families. Teamsters1932.org.
NBC News Radio, I'm Brian Shook. Details of David Pecker's involvement in former President Trump's alleged hush money payments came to light in court Thursday. Jonathan O'Halloran reports.
Pecker took the stand for his third day of testimony.